Welcome to the March 10th service of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Blacksburg, Virginia. The service today is led by our settled minister, Reverend Pam Phillips, and the theme for the service is Women Trailblazers. The podcast begins with opening words and then A Time for All Ages, both by Worship Associate Victoria Taylor. A responsive reading by Margaret Fuller, titled A New Manifestation, is not included in the podcast, but Rev Pam referenced it several times during her sermon.
So this is, last month, you may remember, was Black History Month, and this month is Women's History Month, and on the 8th was International Women Day of the Woman. So today we're talking about the female side of our denomination. And Rev Pam, in preparation for this, I said, well, you've got to give me some information about the female side of this denomination. And she led me to this book, The Prophetic Sisterhood, Liberal Women Ministers of the Frontier, 1880. Okay. I didn't know that was the frontier, but this book actually clunked this part of my life of how I became a Unitarian, and I didn't even know it existed until she gave me the book. So I am married to a man from Iowa. And in 1880, Iowa was the frontier. Humboldt, Iowa was actually the hotbed of Unitarian Universalism. Unitarianism, it wasn't Universalism then. And I have three amazing sister-in-laws. And I was a New York Jewish intellectual. We didn't think there were amazing liberal free thinkers in Iowa. And I have learned my lesson. And when I read this book, I realized the tradition of my sister-in-laws and the tradition of the liberal women of the frontier. And one of the things that one of these liberal women was named Carrie Bartlett. And I read about Carrie Bartlett's journey to Unitarianism, and it so spoke to probably mine, yours, and yours. So she was a young woman, and as a child, she rebelled against the... So I'm reading from the book, not quoting Carrie Bartlett. This is written by Cynthia Tucker. So this is in the 1870s. She is a young, restless woman in Iowa. And as a young child, she had rebelled against the religion, having never been able to think that a God worth caring about could inflict pain. She flatly refused to swallow the teachings that unbaptized babies were sent to hell, and that Jesus, for whom she felt affection for as a human being, could have been involved in anything as impossible as the resurrection. She agonized over this, never seeing what good it did, and she rejected it wholesale along with Jesus' atonement. But something inside her insisted that God's power made sense in everyday life. And when she aired her objections, she was rebuked. Unable to silence her private revolt, she was about to have resigned herself to being damned, when her father took her to hear a Unitarian deliver his town hall lecture. And at that moment, those words dissolved all her fears on the spot, and she wanted to be a Unitarian minister. We're going to play a Who Am I game. We're going to give them riddles about famous Unitarian Universalist women, okay? Will you be my first woman, River? Great. So, you hold this up to your face. Okay, you ready? I was born in... Let everybody see what you look like, the kids, because they can't see you. Yeah. I was born in Boston in 1832. My father was a school teacher who kept company with Ralph Waldo Emerson, and my uncle was a Unitarian minister. We were a very progressive family. Ideologically, we didn't use animal products. We read the Transcendentalists and supported abolitionists and women's suffrage. I was educated at home. This sounds like my family. Educated at home, and while I never liked arithmetic, I loved reading and writing and natural history. After the Civil War, I wrote a book for girls based on my family's experiences. It was very successful, so I continued to support my family by writing children's books. Who am I? So this woman, thank you, River, was Louisa May Alcott. All right, who's next? This lady. All right, let everybody see who you are. I grew up in England in the 1700s, while Thomas Paine and other intellectual radicals argued for the rights of man, I thought we should argue for the rights of women and men. I believed in the innate rights of all people without distinction of class, age, or gender. I became an advocate of co-education and personal responsibility. I wrote several books, but I died before I was 40. Who am I? I hear it. Nope. Mary Wollstonecraft. All right, this.
I wrote Frankenstein.
Yeah? Oh, you're next? Okay. Oh, this is one of my faves. Stand up, let the kids see who you are. While I am mostly known as a poet and playwright, I was also an anti-war activist, suffragette, and preacher. My most famous poem was written in the middle of the night after watching Lincoln's Union soldiers attacked by Confederate soldiers, placing her around the 1860s. I sold it to The Atlantic, a popular literary magazine, for $5, and within months, it was the rallying song for the Northern troops. Another legacy of my anti-war activism is that I organized the first Mother's Peace Day in 1872, and that day is still celebrated on the second Sunday in May. Who am I? Yes, Julia Ward Howe. And the song for the kids was Battle Hymn of the Republic. All right, who's next? This one's one of my faves. Who wants to be? Okay, here we go. You better stand up high. Can you help her up on the top step? Just put her on the top step. Just put her on the step. There you go. All right. This lovely woman was born in China in 1876 because her parents were Presbyterian ministers. She studied education in New York at Columbia Teachers College. Through her work with children, she became fascinated by the big questions rather than the big answers. She realized that children could come to know God through original approaches of their own to the universe. She began developing stories and curricula for religious education. In 1937, she began working for the Unitarians, and in 1959, she was like 80, I was ordained as a Unitarian minister. Some people consider me the mother of religious education. Who am I? Sophia Lyon Foss, yeah. Didn't she look nice? She's one of my babes. All right, who's next? How about you? All right. I was born in Illinois in 1851. She is one of the frontier women I was talking about earlier. At an early age, I played church by preaching on a stump to anyone who would listen. I found my father's library, though, and began to read about abolition and Darwinian evolution and biblical fallacy. I began to question the assumptions of my society. And after meeting Eleanor Gordon, we dedicated our lives to expanding opportunities for women in the Unitarian Church. I was called as a minister in 1885 in Humboldt, Iowa. I believed most of all, quote, true religion must first of all be free religion. Who is this?
Mary Stafford.
Yeah, Mary Stafford. All right, you all got Mary Stafford. All right, one more. It's taking kind of a long time, but it's fun. Who wants to be this one? Okay. I was a woman born of free African-American parents in 1825. This is a long time ago. As a young woman, I worked for abolition and women's suffrage. My family was African Methodist Episcopal, but in 1870, I joined the First Unitarian Church of Philadelphia. In fact, in Philadelphia, I was one of the first women to refuse to sit in the colored section of the trolley car. I wrote several short stories and novels, one's called Iola LeRae, and it is acclaimed as the first novel written by an African-American woman in the United States. My most famous poem is entitled, Bury Me in Free Land. Who am I? No one knows? Frances Harper? Y'all need to read her books and poems. All right, thanks for playing. I hope y'all learned something.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come. As we consider what it means to be a people of journey, it is good to think about those who came before, blazing a trail for us as we make our way in the world. And because this is Women's History Month and International Women's Day was Friday, it seemed especially appropriate to consider the woman trailblazers of our movement. Those Unitarian and Universalist women whose work made it possible for Victoria and me as women to lead worship today. Now, the origins of Women's History Month go back to 1978 in Sonoma County, California, where the school district held a week-long celebration of women's contributions to culture, history, and society. They had presentations at school, a real woman essay contest. I should have had you play I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar today. And they had a parade in downtown Santa Rosa. Now, this congregation has connections to Santa Rosa because that's where my husband, Jamie, became a Unitarian Universalist, and that's where the congregation ordained him to ministry. And it's also where this congregation's previous minister, Rev Dara, is now serving that same church. Over the next few years, the practice of Women's History Week became more popular until President Jimmy Carter proclaimed it a national week. And then in 1987, Congress passed a resolution for a national Women's History Month. It's kind of weird having a History Month for your people. It just seems odd to me. International Women's Day had its origins much earlier, in the early 1900s, when women's oppression and inequality was spurring women to become more vocal and active in campaigning for change. The IWD website starts its timeline in 1908, when 15,000 women marched through New York City, demanding shorter hours, better pay, and voting rights. The next year, the Socialist Party of America, we've been hearing a lot about socialism lately, they declared the first National Women's Day in the U.S. And in 1911, the first International Women's Day was held. And they continue to be held. This year's theme is balance. So that everybody's supposed to balance. Advocating for the creation of a gender-balanced world. And it's all year long, people. So if you can get a picture of yourself balancing genders, you can post it online. Hashtag balance is better. Women's History Month then looks to the past, celebrating those who have come before, while International Women's Day looks to the present and the future, a celebration of women, but also a call to action to make the world more equitable. And today we're lifting up and learning about our past, celebrating women trailblazers with an eye to our present and our future, finding in their struggles the inspiration to continue their work. Now, as I was working on this service, I received an email from a state delegate reminding me that voting on the Equal Rights Amendment was shot down in this year's General Assembly. Still waiting for the ERA, people. There is much work to be done. So let our foremothers inspire us to keep on working for justice. A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come. These are the optimistic words of Margaret Fuller, one of the amazing women who blazed a trail for us as Unitarian Universalists. So I'm going to admit right up front, I am a history geek. So you are going to get a history lesson. So I want to give you a lens through which to look. As I tell you about Margaret Fuller's life, I want you to imagine it as a movie. What kind of movie is her life? She was born in 1810 and was raised by Unitarian parents who gave her opportunities for education that most women at that time were not afforded. Her father started teaching her to read at 3. She was translating Latin at 6. Can you see the scene? She became a true intellectual and was said to be the most widely read person in all of New England, male or female. Ralph Waldo Emerson invited her to join the Transcendentalist Club and then to edit their magazine, the very influential The Dial. She did that for 2 years, and apparently they forgot to pay her. She wrote articles for the magazine, one of which she expanded into her seminal book, Woman in the 19th Century, from which some of the lines of our reading come. It was published in 1845, and it was lauded by Horace Greeley, who wrote, "If not the clearest and most logical, it was the loftiest and most commanding assertion yet made of the right of woman to be regarded and treated as independent, intelligent, rational being, entitled to an equal voice in framing and modifying the laws she is required to obey, and in controlling and disposing of the property she has inherited or aided to acquire. Hers is the ablest, bravest, broadest assertion yet made of what are termed woman's rights." Now, Greeley was so impressed with her that he hired her to write for the New York Tribune. And eventually she became a foreign correspondent, traveling to Europe, which is how she came to be living in Italy and writing about and then supporting the Italian Revolution in the late 1840s. So imagine her in Italy. She volunteered at a hospital. It's also there that she met a younger man, Giovanni Asli, with whom she had a child. We're not sure whether they were married or not. But after Rome was invaded, they had to escape to Florence, which is where they got to live together openly. The family was returning to the United States when their ship wrecked, only 100 yards from Fire Island, off of Long Island, and they all drowned, and only the baby boy's body was recovered. She was only 40 years old. I love the story of her life, how she cultivated her mind, being welcomed by the intellectual elite of Boston during a time of rich public discourse, how she didn't let being a woman keep her from doing what society at the time didn't allow other women to do. She was apparently the first woman allowed to use the library at Harvard College as she was researching her first book. I love that she found love with a man 11 years her junior, who is described as beautiful, tall, of little culture, but of Mazzini ideals. I found that on Wikipedia, and it was in Italian. That's the English translation, so I'm sure it sounds even better in Italian. I am surprised no one has made a movie of her life. Who would you have play her? What actress? Something to think about. Perhaps the part of her life that I loved the most, though, was her profound impact on the lives of women of her time, not just in writing, but in conversation. Here's how it's described in the Online Dictionary of Unitarian and Universalist Biography. It is a treasure trove of UU history, and I'm going to ask Arthur and Lisa to put the link to it on the webpage so that you can do some exploring of some of the amazing women that I'm not going to be able to talk about today. But it says, in Elizabeth Peabody's West Street Bookshop, Fuller held several series of conversations that attracted women of the city and surrounding area who were intellectuals and social activists. The circle included many Unitarians, Lydian Emerson, Ralph Waldo's wife, some other names you might not know, Lydia Maria Child, Elizabeth Maria, Mary and Sophia Peabody, and Lydia, Mrs. Theodore Parker. Though women might be taught the same subjects as men, they had little opportunity to use their learning. Fuller provided a setting where they could discuss what they knew, free to explore ideas and speak their own thoughts on such topics as classical mythology, education, ethics, the fine arts, and woman. Men were included in one evening series, but apparently it was less successful than the women-only sessions. Income from the conversations supported Fuller for 5 years. And it supported her family as well. Her father died when she was young, and she supported her family. As we consider the women who blazed the trails for us as Unitarian Universalists, I had to include Margaret Fuller because she created opportunities for women of her time to cultivate their minds and ideas. And these women were themselves trailblazers. Among the women who participated in the conversations, there were scholars and educators, including one who opened a school for girls and another who founded the kindergarten movement in the United States. They were novelists and editors, journalists. They were also abolitionists, women's rights advocates, and even a Native American rights advocate. And they were all Unitarians. And apparently some of these women were able to bridge the gap between the Unitarians and the Transcendentalists, because there was a widening gap between them. A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come. When I read that, knowing that it was written in 1845, I was skeptical that Margaret Fuller was as optimistic as all that. After all, women's suffrage was a long way away. And I spent a little too much time looking for the text from which our reading came, because that is what I do. I get something in my head and I just can't let go of it. Because I couldn't imagine that the words that we read today were the ones that Fuller wrote. And it turns out they're not. Instead, the committee that put together the Gray Hymnal seems to have pulled together words from her writing to create something inspiring. As I read through parts of Fuller's book, I admit that her prose is pretty dense and hard to get through. Really hard to get through. So I understand their impulse. But when I looked for that repeated line, a new manifestation is at hand, a new hour is come, like it's already here, it turns out the original was, yet no doubt, a new manifestation is at hand, a new hour in the day of man. Capitalized, man. She didn't say that the hour is come. I'm guessing that the committee made the revision to update the language and make it less sexist. Thank you for that. But the original makes me think that my skepticism was warranted. Likewise, I found a blog written by Everett Howe, who was a seminarian at the time, and it turns out there were a lot of things in the reading that we shared together. that aren't exactly the way she wrote it. He said that one sentence began on one page, and then 100 pages later was the second part of the sentence, and they stuck them together. And then there was another one that didn't just change account for the dated language, but it changed the meaning. So we read the line, "Man does not have his fair share either. His energies are repressed and distorted by the interposition of artificial obstacles." But the next line was, "But he himself has put them there. They have grown out of his own imperfections." It changes the meaning just a little bit. Now, I don't say all this to denigrate the reading or to criticize the people who created the hymnal, but I just felt like it was important that we know the rest of the story. When reading the words of a woman who blazed the trail for the rest of us, I think it's important to know and honor her original words and her intentions. A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come. The other trailblazer I want to lift up this morning, unlike Margaret Fuller, lived a long but also extraordinary life. And instead of being born in the intellectual milieu of Boston, Olympia Brown was born in a log cabin in Kalamazoo County, Michigan, to Universalist parents in 1835. Like Margaret's, though, Olympia's parents were determined that she have an education. Her father built a schoolhouse on their property and then went around to the neighbors collecting money so they could hire a teacher. After completing school in a neighboring town, she convinced her parents to let her go to college. And she went to Mount Holyoke Seminary for Women, but that lasted only a year because their Calvinism really clashed with her Universalist upbringing. So then she went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio, where she first heard the Congregational preacher, Antoinette Brown Blackwell. Brown wrote later in her autobiography, "It was the first time I heard a woman preach, and the sense of victory lifted me up. I felt as though the kingdom of heaven were at hand." Y'all feel that way when I preach, right? Well, Brown, after hearing Blackwell preach, was determined to go to seminary, but was refused by what would become the seminary that I attended, the Unitarian School of Meadville, Pennsylvania. She applied to the Universalist Divinity School at St. Lawrence University in New York. And its president sent her a letter offering her admission, but added that he did not think that women were called to the ministry, but I leave that between you and the great head of the church. This, Olympia thought, was exactly where it should be left. But when she arrived, she was told she had not been expected and that Mr. Fisher had said she would not come as he had written so discouragingly to her. So much for his discouragement. Olympia Brown completed her studies in 2 years and then had to convince the ministers to ordain her. Though some objected, including the president of the seminary, a parish wanted to call her to the ministry of their church. And one of the members of that church was on the ordaining council of the St. Lawrence Association. So it's not just what you know, it's who you know. So Olympia Brown was ordained in 1863, becoming the first woman to achieve full ministerial standing recognized by a denomination in the United States. Now, she served three churches. Her first was in Weymouth, Massachusetts, where she served for 6 years. Most notable for me about this ministry was the willingness of her congregation to give Brown a four-month leave of absence so that she could go to Kansas to campaign for a woman's suffrage amendment. It was an arduous trip. She made 300 speeches. and it ended with only 1/3 of the voters approving the amendment. But apparently, Susan B. Anthony considered it a glorious triumph. You got to remember that all of those voters were men. Her next church was in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Most notable, other than the fact that P.T. Barnum was a member of that congregation, was that she married her husband while serving there. I was surprised and delighted to read that her mother and friends discouraged her from getting married because they thought it would impact her career. But in her words, she thought that with a husband so entirely in sympathy with my work, marriage could not interfere, but rather assist it. And so it proved, for I could have married no better man. He shared in all my undertakings. I especially loved reading that part because I have that in common with her. Sadly, though, a small faction of the Bridgeport congregation agitated for the termination of her ministry when she was on maternity leave. And so she decided to leave. Some things never change. Her final church was in Racine, Wisconsin. When she wrote the church, the congregation offering her services, the clerk wrote back admitting that they had had a series of ministers who had left the church, and I quote, adrift, in debt, hopeless, and doubtful whether any pastor could again rouse them. She took the job. There was a passage that I was going to quote, but she talked about how she went to churches that other people wouldn't go to, but she reminded the reader that those were the plum spots that the men were getting. So she took what she could get. So her husband moved to Wisconsin first and became one of the owners of the local paper and worked actively to support his wife's ministry. She worked hard and was able not only to rejuvenate the church, but also establish it as a center of learning and cultural activities by bringing in famous speakers like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Julia Ward Howe, and Susan B. Anthony. Are you sensing a trend there? After 9 years, though, she decided to leave the church and change careers at the age of 53, becoming an activist for women's rights. She was an organizer and a leader at the state and national level, continuing to advocate for women's education as well as an amendment giving women the right to vote. She even joined the Woman's Party when it formed in 1913. And I love this passage from the website. In freezing rain, in bitter cold, in spite of dangerous confrontations and little police protection from hecklers, the octogenarian minister from Wisconsin was there. During one memorable demonstration protesting Woodrow Wilson's turning his back on the suffrage amendment, she publicly burned his speeches in front of the White House. I would love to see a movie of that. When the suffrage amendment was finally passed in 1919, Brown was one of the few original suffragists who was still alive to savor the triumph. She voted in her first presidential election at the age of 85. I love the story of her life, how she was determined to get the education she thought she deserved and pursued her goal of ministry. It serves as an inspiration for my own life. And wouldn't it be a really great movie? The last scene with her finally voting after all those years? I would cry. A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come. As I read through the stories of Margaret Fuller and Olympia Brown, as well as the countless other women I could have lifted up today, and thank you so much, Victoria, for lifting up the names and faces of those you did. I was struck by how much we owe them and how far we've come. When I started seminary, there were more women than men in my class. And this congregation has called 3 women ministers. Good for you. Good for me. Thanks be to Margaret Fuller, Olympia Brown, to the women we heard about in our Time for All Ages, and all who followed them. Let us honor them and their trailblazing by finding ways to further their work, to advocate for justice and equity, to pass the ERA, to create heaven on earth. A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come. Well, not quite. But after nearly 175 years, we're getting closer. Let us make it so. Amen.